한국은 한반도 비핵화 의지를 분명히 하였으며 북한에 대한 군사적 위협이 해소되고 북한의 체제 안전이 보장된다면 핵을 보유할 이유가
없다는 South Korea's security advisor Chung Yi-young today after a historic meeting with the North. He said the North clearly expressed its willingness for the denuclearization of the Korean Peninsula. And then he continued, there is no reason for them to have nuclear weapons if military threats against the regime are removed and the safety of the regime is guaranteed. Those military threats he was talking about, those would be from the United States. Remember, fire and fury? Well, we're going to talk about whether this is a big breakthrough or just more bluster with Lisa Collins, Korea expert at the Center for Strategic and International Studies. Hi.
Hi, thanks for having me on the show.
Great to have you. All right, so this delegation goes to North Korea, and this is the first time in many years that a South Korean delegation has visited the North. Why did they go?
So there had been a proposal made by the North Korean leader Kim Jong-un to have an inter-Korean summit when his younger sister visited South Korea for the 2018 Winter Olympics just a couple weeks ago. So he had sent a private letter, a personal message to the South Korean President Moon Jae-in to have a summit. And so this is a response to that initial request.
And what do we know that actually came out of it in terms of substance?
So what we know is that the South Korean side and the North Korean side have agreed to have a inter-Korean summit in April. The exact date is yet to be known, and they're going to have the summit along the demilitarized zone in a special building. It's called the Truce Village building, where the two sides have had working level talks before. But this would be the first time that the North Korean leader Kim Jong-un would actually come down to the South Korean side for a meeting of this stature.
And what is motivating Kim Jong-un to talk about, you know, peace efforts, to talk possibly about halting the nuclear program?
So there are a couple of different perspectives on this, depending on what experts you talk to. Some experts believe that this is an initiative by the North Koreans to ultimately probably get some sanctions relief. Their economy has been hit harder in recent weeks, reportedly, by the sanctions coming out from the United Nations Security Council, as well as the efforts by the United States and other regional allies like South Korea and Japan to enforce the sanctions measures that have already been put into place and to also isolate North Korea diplomatically. So some people believe that North Korea is running low on foreign currency, or its foreign currency reserves are being depleted, and that there's less trade going on between North Korea and China and other countries. And so they're trying to sort of get some relief from that. And then there are other experts who believe that North Korea has a sort of long-term strategy or an elaborate plan to eventually get the United States to engage in a peace treaty or a deal to have a peace agreement between the United States and North Korea that would lead to diplomatic recognition of North Korea, and then it's basically guarantee its security and longevity of the regime.
So does this point to a diplomatic success, or at least a rhetorical success, and also a substantive success in the terms of sanctions for the Trump administration?
So I do think I am one of those people who does believe that sanctions can have an effect and are one of the tools that we can use to help get North Korea to return to talks about denuclearization. There have been reports coming out of China and along the border between China and North Korea that trade is down between the two countries, and that North Korea, at least internally, is being hit a little bit harder by the sanctions than they have been normally in the past. And then there are other people who, of course, are the sort of sanctions naysayers, which I call them. They always say that sanctions aren't working, even if there may be some evidence that they are. Hmm. So it really depends on what perspective you take.
But it's really hard to get actual information out of North Korea in terms of whether or not these sanctions have worked on the ground.
It is. So North Korea doesn't publish its own economic statistics. A lot of the statistics we get are actually what we call mirror statistics from China. Basically, China produces or it publishes the trade numbers with its relationship with North Korea, and that's how we know how much trade is increasing or decreasing between the two countries. And because China is the largest trading partner of the North Koreans, it conducts about 85 to 90% of trade with North Korea and is the biggest economic lifeline for Pyongyang.
Okay, and so South Korea and North Korea have agreed to this April summit. Where does the United States fit in?
It's a good question. I think the National Security Advisor from South Korea is supposed to come to the United States very shortly after his trip to North Korea to talk with the Trump administration officials about the results of the inter-Korean talks. And so we'll see what the United States' response will be to that. I think so far publicly, even this morning, President Trump said we'll see where this opportunity goes. Sounds so far like the Trump administration is at least publicly supportive of inter-Korean dialogue, but it depends on the situation going forward and North Korean actions.
Well, the president tweeted today, maybe false hope, but the U.S. is ready to go hard in either direction, exclamation point. What do you make of that?
So, of course, the Trump administration has been diligently pursuing this maximum pressure strategy, which basically consists of increased sanctions and diplomatic isolation of North Korea. And then from time to time, there has been talk about dialogue. So I think he's talking about either one of those situations, either further dialogue between the two Koreas that also leads to direct talks between the United States and North Korea, or as he said, also in other state, President Trump has said in other statements, if dialogue doesn't work, then maybe other secondary options will be on the table. And of course, the secondary options, we can all imagine what those might be.
Yeah. Well, I mean, in a way, do you think that that works, the saber rattling on the part of the president?
It really depends, again, on your perspective. Some think that these sort of rhetorical, blustery pressure tactics have an effect, and some people don't. I think it's much more important what the United States does in terms of actions, and I think the sanctions designations that have been handed down through the U.S. Treasury Department are probably some of the most, the strongest concrete actions that the Trump administration has followed through on throughout this, the last several months. But I think the Twitter talk doesn't necessarily help the situation in a lot of ways.
Mm. And how credible is it that North Korea is pretty close to developing the technology to send a nuclear-tipped missile to the mainland of the United States?
So if you talk to most nuclear scientists or people who study North Korea's missile program and their nuclear weapons program very closely, they say it's only really a matter of time before North Korea develops this technology. There's some debate around what kind of technology they still need to perfect in order to have a nuclear intercontinental ballistic missile that would reach the United States. Some people believe that North Korea still needs to prove that they have what's called a reentry technology, which is basically the technology to keep a missile tip from burning up in space as it comes down through the atmosphere. But I think that, it's, again, most people believe it's only a matter of time before they actually have that technology, given their testing pattern over the last couple years.
Right. And so given the statements today, you can see why people are skeptical, right, that he would actually go through with any denuclearization.
Yes. I mean, I think there are skeptics, and I'm probably one of those skeptics. But then again, there are people who believe that this might be a very positive turn of events that could eventually lead to longer talks on denuclearization that would eventually get North Korea to agree to either freeze or roll back their nuclear weapons program. So we'll just have to wait and see.
Lisa Collins is an expert on Korea at the Center for Strategic and International Studies. Lisa, thank you.
Thank you.
Coming up, former rap mogul Suge Knight's lawyers are indicted on witness tampering charges. So what does that mean for Knight's murder trial that's coming up next month? We'll have that story next on Press Play.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. Rap mogul Suge Knight's murder trial took another big twist this week. Two of his attorneys have been indicted on charges they tried to tamper with witnesses. The two men, Matthew Fletcher and Thaddeus Culpepper, face nearly 4 years in prison if convicted. James Quealy has been reporting on this case for the Los Angeles Times. Hi there.
Hey, how you doing?
Great. Okay, so both attorneys were in a downtown courtroom yesterday, and did they admit guilt or plead innocence or what?
As weird as this case has been, the two attorneys might walk into court and immediately plead guilty. No, that did not happen. Mr. Fletcher and Mr. Culpepper were both, they had likely been aware that the indictment had been returned against them, so they appeared in court yesterday, just more of a summons to appear. No guilty plea was entered. Basically, the indictment was unsealed and the charges were made public. There's another court hearing. There's an arraignment on March 16th where they'll enter pleas, but that hasn't happened yet.
But this indictment has been around for a while, right? The grand jury returned it in January?
Right. The grand jury, if you remember, they were arrested in late January. The grand jury apparently returned this indictment the day before their arrest. We were not aware of that until yesterday. The indictment was sealed until yesterday morning. But this is all back to the kind of witness tampering allegations that have been floating around the case since last summer.
Mm-hmm.
The prosecutor's office had filed a motion that accused both Matthew Fletcher and Thaddeus Culpepper of various possible witness tampering charges that they had discussed, paying money to witnesses, that Culpepper had actually drawn up a declaration for a person who told him he'd not witnessed the crime, but was willing to do whatever, say whatever, to help out Suge Knight. So there have been these allegations have kind of been floating around, like I said, for close to 8 months now, six, eight months. But this is the first time that you've seen formal charges filed against any attorneys in the case.
Okay, so let's take that witness tampering allegation in detail. So the guy who said that he was approached and offered money to testify for Suge Knight, he was actually an informant for the sheriff's department?
Right. So the kind of streamlined version of that is sometime in 2016, the sheriff's department gets an informant next to Suge Knight on a prison transport bus. He approaches him, tells him he's about to be released, and he knows who he is, and he'll do whatever to help him. Suge Knight gives him the name of one of his attorneys, not Matthew Fletcher or Thaddeus Culpepper, somebody else. As you know, there have been a parade of attorneys involved in this case.
Mm-hmm.
The informant then approaches both Fletcher and Culpepper, and according to transcripts of these recorded conversations that have been in some of these court filings, at one point this person tells Thaddeus Culpepper that he didn't witness the crime. He was not there at Tam's Burgers on the day of the car accident back in 2015, but that he is more than happy. He's willing to say whatever it takes to help Suge be exonerated, but it's going to cost him, a few dollars. It's going to cost him some money. And according to the transcripts I'm reading yesterday, Thaddeus says, of course, in reply. There's no specific dollar amount discussed, but that's the potential witness who's is a sheriff CI that is being discussed here.
But why would this sheriff CI, and that stands for criminal informant, right?
Yep.
Why would he sort of take it upon himself to offer to do this? Is this, that seems a little shady in terms of the actual charges around Suge Knight, right?
I don't actually know what the sheriff's strategy was here with regards to that specific informant. We do know prior to any of that happening, the sheriff's department claimed it had developed information that there was discussion of witness tampering going on in the case, and they had already gotten permission to listen to some of the jailhouse recorded phone calls. In those calls, again, this is according to their prosecutor's filings, Matthew Fletcher had apparently already been discussing potential witnesses in the case who might need to be paid to give favorable testimony. He actually mentioned to Suge that something in the range of $20,000 to $25,000 might be, and this is a verbatim quote, a fair investment to secure his freedom. He even discussed paying off Cleobone Sloan at one point, who is the man who was hit by the car who survived. So all of this had happened in phone conversations, I believe, prior to the introduction of the informant to the case. I don't know what the sheriff's exact strategy was with the informant, but they seem to be gathering information that there was discussion of witness tampering going on prior to the informant's involvement.
So this would be like separate to the original charges of murder and attempted murder.
Mostly. One of the charges they're indicted on, accessory, is actually accusing both lawyers of being accessories after the fact to the murder itself, basically that by witness tampering they'd be helping Knight cover up or otherwise dodge prosecution in the case.
So this is unusual, right, for the DA to go so hard after the defense attorneys?
Most of the legal experts I've talked to, you know, it's not unheard of for defense attorneys to get arrested or charged. It's rare, especially to have it happen in the course of a case.
Yeah.
You know, we haven't gone to trial here yet, as you know. So
right, so it seems like there are two separate things happening at the same time.
Yeah, there's a whole bunch of other there's the three different criminal cases Suge is facing, and then there's pretty much everyone in Suge's orbit seems to also have been getting into trouble with the district attorney's office lately. You know, his fiance was sentenced to 3 years in prison on a probation violation earlier this year. Another one of his business partner, Mark Blankenship, is still facing charges for possibly facilitating the leak of the video of the murder to TMZ. His current attorney, while not criminally charged, has been accused of possibly having a conflict of interest in the case because she might have helped him violate a different court order for a different reason. So pretty much most of Suge's team allies, even a PI that's working for him, was thrown out of the courtroom during a hearing I was at on this case a couple of weeks ago.
Yeah. Okay, so what about these two lawyers, Matthew Fletcher and Thaddeus Culpepper? Where do they come from, and why would they agree to represent Suge Knight if this would be the outcome?
I don't know if they knew it was going to be this vicious from the beginning, but Culpepper's been the attorney on the robbery he's accused in 2014 for a long time. So that took place before the murder allegation surfaced. So he's been involved in this from prior to it being a kind of the full-fledged media circus it is now. He did put himself back on as co-counsel in the murder case recently, actually after he was arrested. I don't know why that happened. It's kind of bizarre. Mr. Fletcher, you know, there's some of the recorded conversations, some of the motions. Fletcher kind of refers to having known Mr. Knight from when they grew up together. Matthew also is just in general. He's a regarded lawyer in homicide cases. He's got experience covering gang-related cases, high-profile issues. So he's kind of a guy that you might logically seek out here.
Yeah. So he's represented by high-powered attorney Mark Garagos.
Yes.
And their defense is going to be that it's not okay to have those conversations between the attorney and their client recorded. They're going to get those recordings thrown out. Is that their strategy?
Vaguely, that's what they've hinted at. Mr. Garagos wasn't even present in court yesterday, so I'm imagining when we get to the arraignment in 2 weeks, we might know a lot more as to what Mr. Fletcher and Mr. Culpepper's defense is going to be and you know, what Mark has to say about that.
Okay, so these guys are facing some prison time. They haven't been arraigned yet, but I assume they're going to plead not guilty, meaning they might go to trial, meaning they're going to be pretty busy. How are they going to represent Suge Knight, whose trial is scheduled to begin next month?
That's a very good question, and that's something that, you know, and why we've known about these allegations coming to this point is because the DA's office has repeatedly filed these conflict motions more or less to advise Suge that, hey, we could use the evidence here of possible witness tampering, that the suggestion that your lawyers are up to no good against you at trial. They could even face criminal charges and, like you said, could have their own legal perils to deal with. So I don't know how that's going to work. I mean, obviously, you know how the court system works here. You're not going to have a trial on calendar on these tampering charges anytime soon. Matthew Fletcher, just to be clear, is no longer an attorney of record in this case and has not been for something going on 2 years now. So Fletcher's conflict would not affect Suge in any way. But for Mr. Culpepper, yeah, he's the co-counsel on the murder case, so he's going to have a lot going on.
James Quealy covers crime and policing for the LA Times. Thank you.
Thank you.
Coming up, the fantasy Hollywood versus the real life Hollywood, what you can learn about celebrity and near celebrity on a TMZ tour.
Somebody said you probably stand a better chance of seeing a celebrity at Gelson's.
That's next on Press Play.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. There's Hollywood and there's Hollywood, like Wall Street and Wall Street, or Mecca and Mecca, places both real and fantasy.
I asked her, what's come over you?
I'll tell you what's come over her. She's just a silly little girl whose head has been turned by the movies. And the sooner she forgets the whole thing, the better off she'll be.
Why will I be better off? What's wrong with wanting to get out and make something of myself? What do you do that's so much better? Just because you're satisfied to sit here all your life, you think you can laugh at me. Well, someday you won't laugh at me. I'm going out and have a real life. I'm going to be somebody.
Yes, that's from A Star is Born. Well, Hollywood has now returned to the real after Sunday's Academy Awards. The red carpet is gone, the streets are open again, and the TMZ tour bus is rolling along.
So if all of you were here about 35 years ago, this building that we're going to pass, it's just across the street here on the right-hand side. It says restaurant available in the windows. You'll see it. Well, it used to be an El Pollo Loco. And good old Brad Pitt would dress up like a chicken and hand out flyers for the restaurants because he couldn't afford his rent otherwise.
Okay, that little factoid from a tour that Carolina Miranda took. She also went to the Oscars to find out where real and fantasy Hollywood collide. She writes the Culture High and Low column for the LA Times. Hi there.
Hello. Thank you for having me.
Great to have you. Okay, who knew that about Brad Pitt? And
I know. It makes me like him, the chicken suit. A chicken suit always gets me.
Okay, so you took the TMZ tour. What else did you do?
I spent a week kind of chasing fame in LA. Like so many of the tourists who come here, they come. I know that my family from South America, they come and they want to see Hollywood. And you have to explain to them that Hollywood is really an idea and it's as much of an abstraction to people who live here as it is from people who from other places. But they still want to see it. And so where do you take them? Where do you take them so that they can touch celebrity? And a lot of times, you know, it's the Walk of Fame. It's doing celebrity home tours. Maybe if you're old school, picking up a star map.
Does that still exist?
You know, there's still a few that hover here and there, but it's a dying art.
Yeah. Maps to stars' homes.
Exactly. But I feel like so many people come to Los Angeles and it's their idea of Los Angeles, that they're going to come here and they're going to see celebrities and there's going to be movie stars and it's going to be so glamorous. And then you take them to the Hollywood Walk of Fame. And when I was growing up in the 70s and 80s, it was not what it is now.
It was even seedier.
It was way seedier. We only went during the day. And it was this thing where invariably people came away disappointed with, you know, this is the Hollywood that I've been hearing. And seeing in the movies.
Yeah, it's pretty grimy. Okay, so you take this TMZ tour and they kind of say, well, maybe you'll see a celebrity.
So if you do spot someone, let me know as soon as possible so we can pull the bus over, grab the camera, and of course, interview them. And of course, we pitched the footage to the TMZ show, so you guys might all be on the show this week. A lot happening, a lot of people getting their hair and makeup done, so be sure to be looking at all of those storefronts.
Okay, well, that's exciting. The promise of seeing a celebrity and also maybe of being a celebrity on the TMZ show. Did you see any?
No, we did not. You know, somebody said you probably stand a better chance of seeing a celebrity at Gelson's than
true.
On a TMZ tour.
Oh my gosh. Did you see anything exciting?
We did. You know, the funny thing about the TMZ tour is it's very much that it's about kind of going to these, you're chasing this ephemeral thing. And what it does is it takes you to the physical places that celebrities have been. So I think for a lot of Angelenos, the tour will be quite pro forma. Like, you know, there's the Viper Room where River Phoenix passed away, or there's the Chateau Marmont where all of the celebrities stay. Like if you drive around Los Angeles all the time, it's no big deal. But for out of towners, it's being able to put this physical space to an idea that they have of Hollywood. I think for me, the most interesting part were like the super banal things like the Brad Pitt El Pollo Loco that is now shuttered. Or my other favorite was we went by a street sign in Beverly Hills where Kanye West once bonked his head. And, you know, while you're on the tour, they're playing this video of Kanye West bonking his head. And you're like, and I, you know, you can be damn sure that if I am leading someone around Beverly Hills, I'm going to point that sign out. Like, there's the sign where Kanye
but also it's
head.
Like selling the TMZ story of the bonking on
yes
the head.
It's a two-hour TMZ commercial essentially, right. Is what you're paying to sit on,
right? Okay. And so did you also you took other tours?
I took a Paramount Studios tour, which the studio tours are very different because the studio tours are very much about the craft of filmmaking and less about, you know, this idea of chasing celebrity and going after the famous. So you're learning about how, you know, ocean scenes are shot, like how their water tank works, how the sound stages work, how sound mixing can create atmosphere in a film. Like, you're learning all of these.
So that's
these,
interesting.
And it's super, super interesting. But you still have these like slight moments of absurdity. Like at the end of the tour, you go into this room that has all of these props from films. And, you know, one of the guides was like, and that's the mask that Will Ferrell puked into in Blades of Glory. And, you know, there's the mask that Will Ferrell puked into in Blades of Glory. I was actually kind of excited to see it.
Maybe not touch it.
Yeah.
Okay. So then you ended this very glamorous week at the Oscars.
Which, I did.
Which is like, for real glamorous.
Which is for real glamorous. It's also this security state. Like, I spend a lot of time covering the U.S.-Mexico border, and I got to tell you that the security at the Oscars would make the U.S.-Mexico border blush. Like, you're going through concrete barricades. There's a blocks-wide cordon. And then also, if you're not a celebrity, they kind of scoot you along the side of the red carpet. You don't walk on the main red carpet. You walk along the side of it. And then they're moving you along. It's like being at a super glamorous TSA line at the airport. They're like, come on, we got to keep it going. Keep it moving. Let's go. Let's go. It's like rush hour on the 405. Come on, people. It's like you landed at the Oscars.
Well, yeah. I mean, they have a five-hour show to get to.
Exactly. Exactly. And then if you're not one of the main celebrities or somebody with them, you get up on the mezzanines, which are kept separate by a velvet rope and a guard from like the main celebrity zone. So you see the celebrity sort of walking in and out of the show. You're not hanging with them by the bar. You know, it wasn't me and the cast of Shape of Water, you know, drinking rum. It was me and like some industry people and journalists in spangly dresses.
Yeah, I went a long time ago and I thought better to stay at home because you can see it better from way up high in the nosebleed section.
Yeah, or stay by the bar because it's pretty entertaining.
Yeah. Okay. So then there are the Oscars. What about the after parties, which are even more glamorous? Did you get into any of those?
I did not get into any after parties. Since I was more interested in how LA deals with celebrity, I actually left the Oscars on foot and walked along Hollywood Boulevard until I was able to leave the security cordon and had a bacon dog.
That is true Hollywood.
That's true LA.
True LA.
Every night ends with a bacon dog.
Yeah. Okay. All right. So what is your grand takeaway from all this?
You know, I think the interesting thing for me is that living in Los Angeles, you know, this idea of a Hollywood as an abstraction has always been something I've considered, and that people come here and they want to see this physical space that embodies all of this fame, celebrity, movie making, and that desire has been fed by our city in some very real ways, that we have created these real spaces in which people can have these experiences that don't consist of meeting or seeing movie stars, but that kind of feed the desire. So everything from the Walk of Fame, the Hollywood and Highland Center, which is inspired by an old movie set, you know, from D.W. Griffith's Intolerance, you know, those elephants in that archway, that the physical landscape of our city has been affected by this desire to chase fame, and that there are these other ephemeral ways of touching on that too, whether it's a TMZ tour or whether it's visiting famous movie locations, you know, like that one restaurant in Chinatown that's still advertising itself as a location for Rush Hour.
Like 50 years later.
Exactly. Hey man, they're milking it.
Whatever it takes.
Exactly.
Everyone's got to get a piece of the celebrity.
God bless.
All right. Carolina Miranda writes the culture high and low column for the LA Times. She's also a regular contributor here at Press Play. Thank you.
Thank you for having me.
Coming growing up, the fantasy of being the star of a TV show was very real for one man who has what's known as Truman Syndrome after the Jim Carrey movie. His story is next on Press Play.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
This is Press Play on KCRW. I'm Madeline Brand. At the end of the movie, The Truman Show, the main character finds out that his whole life has been a TV show. And he's been watched since birth by millions of viewers.
Truman. Huh? You can speak. I can hear you.
Who are you?
I am the creator of a television show that gives hope and joy and inspiration to millions.
Then who am I?
You're the star.
It's Jim Carrey there playing the star of his own television show, his own life, really. In real life, though, there are people who suffer from a delusion that has come to be called Truman Syndrome. It's named after the movie. These people believe they are constantly being filmed and watched by a TV audience. One person who has at times suffered from that delusion is Kevin Hall. He's a former Olympic and professional sailor, and he grew up here in Southern California. His story is told in a new book. It's called The Kevin Show, and I'm joined now by the book's author, Mary Pilon. Welcome, Mary.
Hello.
And Kevin Hall himself. Welcome to you.
Thank you.
Well, Kevin, let's begin with you. When you were in the show, as you call it, there's a director telling you what to do. Can you describe what that's like?
It's like there's stuff I'm just supposed to do, or I have to do, or I must do, and I must do it now. And sometimes it's a compulsion that's a sort of gut level, if you will, or instinctual. And sometimes every once in a while, it's an actual voice saying, no, go get on that bus, or, you know, contemplate getting into that fountain, or go speak to those people who are having that conversation over there.
And it's different than kind of what we have learned about people who hear voices. It's something different than that?
I would never pretend to know what somebody else's experience of hearing voices is. But for me, when I connect with peers around these things, some people hear very distinct, clear voices, sometimes as many as 10 or 15 different voices. And in my head, it's more of a vibe and a compulsion, and then some every once in a while, also a voice.
Mm-hmm. And for some reason, that voice is saying that you are in a movie or a show, you're performing for other people.
Yes.
And when you're in it, you don't know that it's not real.
When I'm in it, I don't know that it's not real. The script has flipped completely, and that's my reality. What I believe in my delusional or psychotic state is my entire reality, and I don't know that it's a problem, so I'm not trying to get out. I'm stuck in there.
And Mary, how common is this delusion?
So Truman Show Disorder is this term that was coined by doctors Joel and Ian Gold. They're brothers, obviously very brainy siblings. But there's, you know, when we start talking about kind of diagnostic criteria and symptoms, I think, you know, to Kevin's point earlier, it gets really complicated. Some people would say that this is a subset of manic depression or bipolar disorder. Some people might call it schizophrenia. Some people might call it you just had a one-time hallucination. So this idea of thinking that you're, you know, part of a larger narrative, you know, as I write in the book, I think it gets really hard to draw those lines. You know, I think because of social media and, you know, smartphones, all of us have some version of this. I mean, what is Instagram if not creating your own PR or publicity machine? So I don't know if I totally answered your question, but I think that Truman Show delusion is more common than at least I thought it was when I started reporting this book.
Although what Kevin describes seems to be a complete break with reality. I guess when we're, you know, on social media, we have one foot in social media, but the other foot firmly, maybe not so firmly, but planted in reality. Like we can look up from our phones and we are in a common reality.
Yes, I totally hear what you're saying. I think that with Kevin, he has been on the national stage. He has been filmed. He has been televised. He was an athlete and, you know, has coached at the highest levels. And so when I set out to do this book, I was curious, and where are those lines being drawn, and how was the psychiatric experience that Kevin was having intersecting with his life as an athlete and as a husband and as a father?
And Kevin, when were you first diagnosed? And I guess you were diagnosed with bipolar disorder?
Yeah, I was diagnosed with manic depression just as the lingo was changing from manic depression to bipolar disorder in 1989. So I had a break with consensus reality. I stopped believing the same thing everybody else did. And then I didn't know how to handle all of the messages and energies that were moving through me. And the people I talked to at the time were sure that that meant I was broken. And so we embarked on a 30-year journey of pathologizing my experiences. And that's one way to handle it. And maybe as the world changes some of its views on some of these things, there will be new ways in the future. But that was my journey.
So you were a junior at Brown at the time?
Yeah. Yep.
And looking back on it, so you had been, you know, pretty involved in competitive sailing. It was a focus of your life. And, you know, you're being groomed for the Olympics. How much of that kind of pressure to perform, as Mary has described it, do you think played into what happened to you?
Pressure is the right place to look. That is definitely the right tree to be barking up. So I won a world championship when I was 16. And I was, you know, the smartest guy in my math class in high school, and I was just supposed to do everything right and win everything. And I got to Brown, and it's not that I wasn't the smartest guy in math class anymore. It's that I had to sit in the back now. And that threw me for a loop, and I don't think I was ready for that. And so one way to tell the whole story is that when I faced that level of having my entire personal world viewed completely disrupted by people who were smarter than me, I didn't know what to do, and I panicked. And the way I panicked was at least very imaginative. I went ahead and made myself the center of the universe.
Hmm.
Wow. So problem solved.
Right.
Solved in my head, right? But not in the real world, and that's where it got tricky.
Yeah. Well, right, because when you are fully into it, you know, and taking your cues from the director throughout your life, there have been some really scary moments, right? I mean, one time he told you to drive your car into Boston Harbor. Another time he told you to jump off the top of a building. And you didn't, thank God, but you were then hospitalized and put on medication. Do you think the medication helped you tame the director, if you will, or control what could be life-threatening experiences?
I think the medication was a good approach at the time, and I think it's interesting to think about what might have happened had we said, whoa, you're experiencing some challenges, maybe some of them on a more spiritual level. What if we just slow everything down here, reduce the stresses, and give you your brain some time to heal? That's another way to go that some cultures get involved with, and our culture doesn't seem to go that direction very often. We just say, whoa, you had these really unusual experiences, and so your brain is broken, and we know how to fix it. And I've been fascinated just recently in finding that not every culture just immediately pathologizes every aspect of my experiences, and sometimes people go on to lead pretty healthy lives without meds.
So you've decided to go off medication?
Yes.
And when did you decide that?
Well, I first decided to do it in 1990 because I wanted to die because I felt so terrible on medication. So I've been trying to talk to people about how it's harder than it looks and it's not as fun as it looks for my entire adult life. But what comes back across the fence is that shows you don't have insight into your illness. So patient says, I don't feel good. I don't know what to do. Doctor says that means you don't understand what is wrong with you. You need more pills. Patient says, huh, and my entire adult life has been like that, except for the last couple years. And the last couple years, we've been changing how we do things, and it's put a lot of strain on the family because emotionally and coping skills-wise, I was 19 when I started working on this, and now I'm a couple years older, but I've got a long way to go as an adult. There are a lot of skills I haven't learned.
And I think when we have this conversation about mental health in this country, there's this very American, we really like fast food, we like fast cars, we like, you know, instant gratification. But I think when we're talking about something as complicated as the human mind, you know, having any one solution for that gets really tricky. I've interviewed people who said meds saved my life. I've interviewed people who said they were terrible for me. I've interviewed people who said, you know, that with a mix of therapy, or I just need to go for a run in the morning. I mean, even within the Truman Show delusion, you know, Kevin's episodes generally were kind of more euphoric, but there are also people I talked to who had very persecutory ones. They're bugging my phones. They're spying on me. And, you know, when I started working on this, I thought, oh, I'm going to write a story about a sailor who has maybe a different challenge. It'll be like A Beautiful Mind with Boats. It's going to be so simple. And as I've, you know, kept going with it, I've realized that it's really complex.
Kevin, you wrote out a checklist that you developed after you had a severe, I guess, episode at Legoland. You and your wife came up with this checklist that would signal when you were headed towards the show and a break with reality. And a lot of the things on this checklist sound really great. I want music in the house more than usual. I sing more passionately. I'm more chatty. I'm more interested in other people. I'm more interested in books and movies and exploring the web. I'm more fun and creative as a father. I'm more interested in sex, etc. I mean, that sounds like a nice way to live, but this list, was it drawn up as a cautionary list? Like these things are signals of something bad approaching?
Thanks for asking about that specifically. That's where the rubber meets the road with why meds are so hard. So those are all things that humans get to experience with their bodies, and when things are going well, all that stuff's normal, and something that Amanda, my wife, and I have been working on together for, over 20 years now, is how to be able to have a lot of normal feelings and then not slip. And it turns out the way I am, when I slip hard and fall really far. And that list helps me be aware that the fact that I'm feeling good right now could become a problem if I'm not really vigilant.
And so when you feel these feelings or you see yourself, you know, going down this path, what do you do?
Try to slow things down. Try to kind of flip back through my recent memories of, you know, the conversation I just listened to that was really interesting to me. Did I put myself in it, or was I still very clear that I was not in it? And just lots of very subtle little cues about facial recognition and intensity of music or intensity of color hues, and just, yeah, try to be aware that if things are getting too good, if I actually really feel good in my body and I'm pretty psyched about life, that might mean I'm sick.
Yeah. And Kevin, you are attracted to authors who have had experience with this, either personally or their relatives have had experience with this, like James Joyce, David Foster Wallace, Philip K. Dick. What do you learn from them when you read their work?
Especially from Philip K. Dick, he's kind of my go-to hero for just continuing to ask the question about what reality is. And a lot of people are pretty sure they know what reality is, but some of us are pretty open to the possibility that we actually really don't know. And I'm one of those people, and I can't let go of the mathematical and scientific and sort of method trainings that I've had in my entire adult life, because many of the experiences I have kind of check out, if you will. And so part of me is like, well, what if there's really something there and we still don't have good maps and good language for it? What if I'm supposed to help try and nudge this conversation along and figure it out a little bit? Like, what if that's my mission that I've been given and that's the anchor that was put in me when I was 5? Now what do I do?
And I think when we started talking about this in 2014, it was a much more academic conversation. And then I got to be honest, when the election happened in 2016 and you couldn't miss the conversation around reality TV and technology, and we think, oh, wait a minute, like I think our country's having a different conversation about what reality means right now.
Yeah. But Kevin, you know, the people around you, they sort of have to deal with it when you're in one of these phases. When you're fully in the show, and it can be kind of scary, right? I mean, you disappear and your wife doesn't know where you've been. And I guess before he died, your dad was pretty angry with you for not taking your medication because he perceived it as irresponsible. And so I'm wondering how you navigate that, like your effect on other people who love you.
That's a heavy question. And we have a little mantra in our family right now, especially, and it's helping us. And that is that we're doing our best and this is what it looks like. But one of the stories I tell myself is when I was 20 years old, I was told that I was broken and that the only legitimate path for me was to swallow these pills every day for the rest of my life. And since that time, I have not only had long periods where I didn't swallow pills and everything was fine, I've also connected with a worldwide community that's not part of the dominant narrative that has gotten off meds and has a good life. The missing information for people is that there is a transition period, and the question you're asking is whether putting your family through that transition period is fair or not. And I guess the way I would answer that right now is that it may not be entirely fair compared to what's perfect, but my life on the inside has been a lot harder than it's looked from the outside.
Mm-hmm. And I thought, you know, when I was trying to set out to figure out whether there was a book here or what that would look like, I read a lot of mental health memoirs, and there are some wonderful ones. I think Kay Redfield Jamison's work is fantastic, and I could point to some others. But in interviewing the folks around Kevin, I realized that was a big dimension of the story. And in the book, the chapter switched perspective, because what I realized in reporting it is that people agreed on the facts, the dates, the times, the places, the very newspaper article elements of the story. But their experiences of those facts were so different. You know, I spent a lot of time thinking about what does this look like from his mom's perspective, from his father's, from his sister's, his teammate. And that was, for me, really powerful. And it was really important to kind of show that a mental illness, whatever we want to call it, isn't just experienced by one person.
And Kevin, so you're not sailing professionally anymore. You coach, but mainly you describe yourself as a stay-at-home dad with three kids. That's a lot of work. And I'm wondering if you have experienced any more episodes. Have you been in the show recently since you decided to go off medication?
I have, and it's not ideal. But each one I've learned from, and that my family's had to carry the slack of me learning. And we're all hoping that that's behind us.
What do they look like?
What do they look like? They look like me believing things that not everybody else believes. Mostly they look like me in a tremendous amount of psychic pain, knowing that I'm letting my family down and not having the coping skills or the sort of personal self-identity and worth to handle it.
Kevin Hall, he is the subject of a new book called The Kevin Show, written by Mary Pilon. Thank you both so much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And Christian Bordahl is here now with some listener comments.
Yes, indeed. Well, we talked earlier about Hollywood and where to take visitors from out of town when they want to see quote-unquote Hollywood. Mm-hmm. So I asked listeners where they take those people. Reedley Film says, well, certainly not to Hollywood. Reginald James kind of agrees. He says, after they see the must-see dump that is Hollywood, I take them to the canals in Venice. Never fails to surprise or please. And then they get to go to the must-see Venice boardwalk. Liz Dwyer says, to the Capitol Records building and Grauman's, and if it's Sunday, to the farmer's market. It's interesting, a number of people mentioned Grauman's, which of course is not called Grauman's anymore.
What is it called?
Well, now it's called the TCL Chinese Theater, because a Chinese electronics manufacturer bought the naming rights back in 2013. For a while, it was called the Man's Chinese.
Oh,
do you remember that?
I remember that.
Yeah, that was another group that bought them naming rights. And then it reverted back to Grauman's in 2001, I think. And now it's TCL.
Hence the confusion.
But, you know, I don't know how much they spent on those naming rights, but clearly it was wasted dollars because everyone still calls it Grauman's. Todd B. says Musso and Frank.
Yeah.
Which is a great old place. In fact, Musso and Frank, I looked it up, opened in 1919. So they're almost, they're ready to have their 100th anniversary there.
Oh.
Yeah.
I think we'll have to celebrate with a martini.
We will. Peter Kalmus takes people to Griffith Park Observatory, which of course always makes me think of James Dean and Rebel Without a Cause when it comes to Hollywood. And our own Jennifer Wolf says to the Hollywood sign and then call it a day. #mission accomplished.
Nice.
So bunch of different places.
Hollywood Bowl, that's a good one.
Hollywood Bowl, yes, absolutely.
And Roscoe's.
Chicken and waffles,
yes.
At 2 in the morning.
Yes. Okay. We'd love to hear your comments. You can tweet us at KCRW Press Play. Christian Bordahl, thank you much. And thanks for listening. I'm Madeline Brand. I'll see you tomorrow.